The vibration of change. That magical place where life shifts from struggle to ease. From stagnation to forward movement. From old ways of being to new ways of becoming. Yes, it can seem rather elusive to get there, but when you are in it, you feel it down to your very core, and it can positively affect everything in your life, from your relationships to your health and well-being, from your career path to your abundance, from the quality of your inner connection to the fullness of your self-expression. Here on the Christine Upchurch Show, we explore ways to get into that vibration of change with experts in the fields of consciousness, psychology, spirituality, health, healing, and science. Are you ready to step into your vibration of change?
Welcome, everybody. You might be listening live on 1150 KKNW in the Seattle area. You might be listening or watching live on transformationtalkradio.com or on Facebook Live on my professional page, or perhaps after the fact on my YouTube channel or one of the dozens of podcasts that sends up. But wherever and whenever you're joining us from today, we're very grateful you're here. And I think you're going to be grateful too, because we are going to be looking at how the transformation within affects the external transformation, something which we need much more of right now. But before I welcome our guest, I'd like to say hello to the people behind the technology, Jacob at TTR. Hey, Jacob.
Hey, Christine. How's it going today?
Good, thank you. And Benny Mathers, I miss seeing you in the studio, Benny, but I can picture your face across the counter. Hey, how you doing?
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad it's memorable. And a high five to Jacob right there.
I'm really excited about our guest today. Somebody who has seen the worst of humanity and has done deep inner work to share the wisdom of what it takes to create transformation in our world. His name is Claude Anshin Thomas, and I'll have to ask him later about if that's the correct way to pronounce his name. He was born in the United States back in the 1940s, and his childhood, he got exposed to violence and abuse. At the age of 18, he volunteered to go into the service as a combat soldier in the Vietnam War. Today, he states that he carries the responsibility of a lot of death and destruction, which is probably so much to carry. After he returned to the U.S., he experienced years of unemployment, which is probably not uncommon amongst veterans, social isolation, violence, and addiction. He began to walk a Buddhist path in 1990, and it led him to his full ordination as a Zen Buddhist monk. He has some great wisdom to share relating to war and our inner transformation. There's this beautiful quote from one of his books: "When war ends here within us, then war ends. If everyone ends the war within oneself, then there are no seeds any longer for which war can grow." And today he speaks publicly, leads retreats and meetings. We're very grateful to have him here today, Claude Anshin Thomas. And please, Claude, tell me if I'm pronouncing that middle name correctly.
Yeah, you do okay.
Okay, tell me how you would pronounce it.
Well, it's really typically American to pronounce that first A hard, Anshin, but really it's a soft A, it's Anshin.
Anshin, yes, yes.
But I'm not so particular.
Yeah, Anshin.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true. Sometimes it's really important to be very particular, but generally I'm not so particular.
So tell me a little bit about your journey, because I know that so many people who go into war return, and of course, I don't know how, I mean, I haven't a clue as to how anybody can heal from that, but so many people never find their way out of addiction and isolation and, being stuck and not transforming their own lives because of so much darkness that they experienced within themselves and within the war. Tell us about your journey.
Well, first I'd like to say that, first I will say that healing is not the absence of suffering. Healing is developing the capacity to live at peace with our unpeacefulness. Mm-hmm. And I think that, what keeps a majority of people who've experienced war, violence, and suffering. And it's not, the consequences of war are not restricted to combat in a foreign country. I think it's important for us to be willing to wake up to the wars that we are confronted with in our daily lives. Mm-hmm. I would say that there's probably not many among us who haven't experienced some sort of violence or trauma in their lives. And so whether it's about the willingness to wake up to those roots of war, violence, and suffering in me, as long as I see the cause of my uncomfortableness externally, or as long as I see the solution to my uncomfortableness externally, healing just won't happen, just won't.
So I think about how you mention in your bio that you grew up with violence and abuse. And unfortunately, I think it's quite common in our world, at least in our culture here in the US. Tell us a little bit about what prompted you to go into the military and how that might have been related to your upbringing.
Well, I was a true believer. And my father was a soldier in the Second War. My grandfather, a soldier in the First War. My great-grandfather, a soldier in the war between the U.S. and Spain. So we call that the Spanish-American War. In Spain, they call it something different. It always depends upon your angle of perception.
Yes.
Now, I grew up also in a very small rural farming community in Northwest Pennsylvania, a town named Waterford, just south of Erie, which is on the lake. I would probably say, and I'm guessing right now, but I'd probably say 60 to 80% of the men my father's age who lived in Waterford had served in the military in some capacity or other during the Second War. I may be off about that. It's really a guess on my part. But I do know that what I was culturally surrounded by was the glorification of combat. I wasn't at any point in time exposed to the truth of it. Mm-hmm. My parents divorced when I was rather young, say 11. I grew up with my father. My father was active in the politics of education in Pennsylvania. He was gone a lot. Plus, the way my father dealt with the consequences of his military service was he anesthetized using alcohol, tobacco, food. He was well liked in the community. I don't know if he was well respected. It seemed like he was well liked. And he was quite successful in the politics of education in Pennsylvania. That meant he was just gone a lot. And because his life was consumed by the intoxicants he was taking, he was also not present emotionally. What kept me in school, and I would have easily left school, but what kept me in high school was the fact that my father taught there, and two, athletics. I was very good. And what my experience with athletics is, and I don't think it's unusual, is that competitive athletics is simply paramilitary training. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at professional athletics, we hear the language of war all the time being reflected, uh-huh. Going into combat with my guys, you know, and you have the flyovers with them, and then you have military jets, or you have military color guard out there with the flag, and you have all of these celebrations of a war culture. At 17, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I was really emotionally, psychologically very immature. And what my father just recommended that I go into the military. He said it would help make a man out of me. interesting. I just did an interview with a with another on another podcast that was, the title of it is The Art of Masculinity. And this is also, I go, the models of masculinity that were present for me growing up, and they're pretty narrow. I didn't have a lot of choices. I didn't have a lot of avenues. In high school, I liked to write. I was a real fan of poetry, and I was humiliated because of that. It didn't fit in with athletic culture. It didn't fit in with the masculine culture. Right. So anyway, my father recommended I go in the military. I joined on the delayed enlistment program. I was actually in the military before I graduated from high school. I graduated. I had about a month, month and a half, and off I went.
So what you were just talking about regarding competitive sports, because obviously, well, there's some sorts of sports, like if you're a pole vaulter or whatever, that's different than being a football player, for instance. But in some of the competitive sports, how it's the, sort of the military mentality, and it brings me back to this concept of tribalism, because I see that come up over and over again within the context of society, the political tribalism, the which side of the medical perspective are you on, that kind of tribalism, the country versus country tribalism. And certainly in sports, there's that concept of us versus them. So considering how we have evolved, hunters, gatherers, and you're talking about masculinity, and I think in terms of the roles that males played, you know, centuries ago, how do you step into a healthier masculinity without having that kind of violent connection to the tribalism, so to speak?
Well, first off, the topic of to label my existence, I already sort of get rid of the labels in my own mind. And so, because as soon as you say masculinity, you're defining it as other than femininity, and that already creates polar opposites. Now, this is one of the aspects of Zen practice, of Buddhist practice, that really caught my attention, that helped me that encouraged me, that sort of moved me to gravitate in this direction, is that they talk about the coexistence of realms. There is the realm of the relative, right, wrong, good, bad, yes, no, masculine, feminine. And then they talk about the absolute realm. That's the realm where there is only truth. So it doesn't matter what my idea, for example, I will say this to people. I don't ask you to agree with me. What I ask you to do is consider this. No matter what idea or theory you have about gravity, if you climb up to the 10th floor and you step off the edge, the truth of gravity is going to show itself. So it doesn't matter what we think. It doesn't matter what we say. It doesn't matter what we believe. It matters how we are in the world. And so, to discover that, I needed to be willing to slow down, to invite more stillness into my life. One of the things that I was told when I first encountered Buddhist practice is that truth was not in the words, but was in the space between the words. I thought that was like crazy. I mean, I go like, what are you talking about, man? That's just, however, the longer I have stayed involved, I've been living as an ordained monastic now for 25 years. The longer I've stayed committed to this simple practice of sitting just to sit, walking just to walk, eating just to eat, the more I've begun to understand the truth. And I even see it further. It's not the space between the words, but even the space between the letters of the words. Our words point in a direction, but depending on what we've inherited from the collective that we're a part of, from the families we come out of, that shapes our perception of the world. Yes. And depending on what, to use a word you just used, depending on what tribe we belong to, how we view the world. The way we view the world is true for us from whatever tribal base we're looking at. And so I'm invited to sort of to allow myself to be deconstructed, to not abandon how I do, not abandon how I was raised and not abandon how I was conditioned, but to be willing to look at that from different angles of perception. And I think this is what's one of the things that's lacking. People are lacking identity. And so they grab onto something external, which is defined, I could define that as the foundations of tribalism. I grab onto something external, that becomes my identity. And I have to defend that with all of my existence. I have to defend that, because if what I've grabbed onto is threatened in any way, then my entire existence is threatened.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And it's sort of, I don't know, it's sort of a double-edged sword as we consider and attempt to deconstruct that belief structure, because we have great attachment, right, to our perception. And we feel safety in that perception. But it seems to me, from my own, the various ways I've deconstructed, and, you know, I don't think I'll ever be there, so to speak, but it's very freeing to let go of it. And yet it's almost like we're hanging onto the edge of a cliff, not willing to fall because we think we're going to fall to our death or our ego death, or whatever. And then we find, oh, you know, I can fall some and I'm still supported. And who am I now? So there's this weird relationship between letting go of attachment and freedom. It's like the attachment freedom kind of double-edged sword.
As you were talking, I keyed on a particular word, attempt to deconstruct.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the issues that I encountered when I first entered into this spiritual path, was that I had all of these ideas. I had all of these ideas of what meditation was. I had all of these ideas about what I just had was full of ideas. And I kept attempting to get my experience to conform to my ideas. So when I talk about the reality of deconstructing, it's not something that I can attempt to do. This is something that's come to me over time. I didn't have this in the beginning, is that the foundation of Zen Buddhist practice is in sitting meditation. So, however, meditation and daily life are not two things. People get confused about this. And so sitting is only a form of meditation. It is in and of itself not meditation. And so incumbent on that, on sitting meditation, is the form of it. So it's not like we can do whatever we want. I mean, we can, but we can't do whatever we want and call that meditation. It leads us down too many false paths. So when sitting, if I sit just to sit and not to accomplish something, then not only do I begin to become revealed to myself, but the world begins to become revealed to me, because my ideas of the world and the reality of the world are not only sometimes do they touch. My understanding of the world when I was 17 years old and being trained to be a combat soldier was that there was an enemy, and that that enemy threatened the safety and stability of a way of life that we valued and treasured. And the solution to that was to eliminate that threat. And I believed, really, I believed it. I was wholeheartedly committed until I stepped off the plane in at Binh Hoa Air Base in South Vietnam. And all of a sudden, I had this moment where I went, holy cow. I mean, that's not what I said at the time. My language is different. But I said, holy cow, this is like for real. This is not a war movie. This is not a glorified comic book that I'm reading. Sergeant Nick Fury and the Howling Commandos. It's nothing like that. This is the real deal. And I could die. That being said, I served my tour. I served honorably. I was injured seriously. I was highly decorated. I was a good soldier. Mm-hmm. Not everything about my service is negative. Uh-huh. However, I didn't have the capacity to really process or work with the immensity of that experience until I met meditation practice, which let me know that healing wasn't the absence of suffering.
Mm, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the interim between when you got home from war and the path you took to try to suppress and avoid that suffering.
Yeah. Well, actually, I wasn't consciously aware that that's what I was doing, sure. That I was attempting to repress or avoid. I mean, I guess at some level I must have known that, but that's speculation on my part at this time. The model that I had was my dad. And my dad was a high school teacher. He taught U.S. history and driver education. Everyone within 25 miles of Waterford, Pennsylvania, who went to high school at Fort LaBeouf, learned how to drive with my dad as the instructor. When my dad came home from school, the first thing he did when he got in the door was he took a 16-ounce water glass, topped it off 7/8 of the way with gin, and then added the rest with Fresca because he was watching his weight. He had two of those in the first 45 minutes. And my father routinely said to me, he said, look, I would rather see you drink beer than Coca-Cola. Am I so okay if I mention brand names here?
Absolutely.
Okay. I just want to be sensitive to that. Some people don't like that. But he said, so if you take a glass and you fill it full of Coke and you set it outside, you put a spoon in there. In 3 days, it's going to eat that spoon right up. He said, that won't happen with beer. And my father, as a backup job, he never had any money. And as a backup job, he was a bartender. And so this is what modeled for me. So when I was discharged from the military, I was discharged out of military hospital. I was discharged with two addictions. One, an addiction to violence, because I saw violence as a solution. And two, to narcotics, because I was being given narcotics on a daily basis for pain. They never stopped giving it to me. And you mix those two are not a good mix. And so my life was, for the longest time, my life was about getting anesthetics, using them, and finding ways and means to get more of them. And when I reflect on it, it's just so sad. It's so painful. And that I survived that is pretty amazing. I will say that my lifestyle led me to a state of hopelessness that was unbearable. And I saw the only solution as death. The overdoses for me were coming closer and closer together. The 13th of May, 1983, I experienced what I hope is my last overdose. And I was in an intensive care unit. Three people came to visit me. And there were three men, and one man asked me if I was going to do this again, meaning the overdose. And I said, yeah, of course. I said, death has got to be better than the life I got. And he looked at me and said, how do you know it's better? Could be worse. And at the time, it was just, there was something about what he said was just piercing. And I went, oh my gosh, worse than this? I had never even considered that. And now I don't know if it's true or not true, but at the time, what was said to me really set me on a path to stop taking intoxicants, not immediately, but shortly then, about a month and a half later, I ended up in a drug treatment center. Haven't used any mood altering or mind altering substances since. Uh-huh. That was the spark that enabled me to begin to create the space for the consequences of my combat service and all of the suffering that I had also inherited from all of those family generations which live in me.
Yes.
Hey, I have a chance. I have the opportunity to heal all of that.
So how does a person come to a place of allowing the suffering, of somehow embracing the suffering? Because if that's, I mean, it's an essential part of life, obviously, but we spend so much time and energy and distractions to avoid the suffering. How do we learn to allow it?
I think we have to have a willingness. We need to have the willingness to live differently without having any without having any idea what that means. That can be true for me today, but it wasn't in the beginning. I had a lot of ideas about what that meant. And that means I just have to keep letting go of those ideas. And I needed to stay disciplined on the path that I was on and trust the people. I trusted, at some level, I mean, I didn't really trust, but at some level I did trust the people whom I connected with. So out of, there was a psychiatrist in the beginning, then there was a social worker. There was a group of like-minded people that I spent time with every day who were committed to living a life like me. And all of that led me to here. I have to really want to, though. I mean, I have so many people tell me, I want to live differently. I want to live differently. Please help me. What do I need to do? And I said, well, first thing, you need to stop taking intoxicants. Okay. They go, well, wait a minute. I don't want to do that. I go, okay. Then what I have to offer won't work for you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so good luck to you. Because I really do believe wholeheartedly that as long as I'm seeking distraction, then I will be driven by my ideas of what healing is supposed to look like. And I'll be imposing that on the world in which I live in. And that only creates more suffering.
That's such an important point, that essentially avoiding the suffering creates more suffering.
Yeah. But it's not a path to embark on alone. Oh, yes. I mean, in the end, we're only alone.
Right.
I'm working with a psychiatrist. I mean, it's still I'm alone. And this person's providing me with some information and some guidance. But what I do with that is my responsibility. Mm-hmm. Same with the social worker. Same with this group of like-minded people. Same with the precepts that I've taken, the vows I've committed to. They all just point in a direction. Mm-hmm. And I need to establish an organic relationship with all of that. Mm-hmm. And I can't be dogmatic about it. I may in the beginning need to be, but it has to become part of me. I have to see, okay, how do all these vows and commitments, how do they work for me? Yeah.
So if somebody is willing to embrace a different approach to life, embrace a path to further healing, how do they choose their support team?
Yeah, I don't know if I chose my support team, or if it just sort of worked out that way. And I mean, when I first went into therapy, I didn't want to go. I was afraid. I wouldn't admit I was afraid. I was afraid. I'm never afraid of nothing. But I was afraid. I was afraid that I was going to discover that I was really crazy. But there was something mentally wrong with me. And that's the stigma that's attached to post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I take the D out of that. I am not disordered. The way I respond to the world around me makes absolute sense based on the circumstances of my life.
That is such an important point, because again, there's that labeling, and it's sort of puts you into a dysfunctional category, or a less than or less lovable category if you have a disorder. Yeah, I love that you want to get rid of that.
Yes. And in the process of working with the realities of post-traumatic stress, I also understood that it wasn't the whole picture. I saw myself as, now I've been wounded. I've been physically wounded. Mm-hmm. But I also saw myself as being emotionally and psychologically wounded, mm-hmm. spiritually wounded. But I didn't know how to articulate that. And because I saw those wounds as being even sort of more profound than being shot or stabbed. Like when I'm shot, I go, okay, I know, this is, I understand. But that I live with this constant existential kind of angst that I couldn't put my finger on. And it just sort of consumed and directed me, and I didn't know what to do with that. And there's another Vietnam veteran. I met him. His name, may I mention his name?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, his name is Camilo Macbica. He's also written a number of books, and he introduced me to the term moral injury. Now, he isn't the first. Once I was introduced to the term, I then began to see it, that other people are working with that now. And to understand that moral injury, the betrayal of what is right by people in positions of power and authority, and that post-traumatic stress is an element of that, but that I'm wounded. So what does it mean, healing from these wounds? Healing means what I've discovered. See, I had to start to give up my ideas what healing meant. And then what I began to discover is that healing means I live at peace with my unpeacefulness. I still have what's termed as a highly disturbed sleep pattern. Been that way since 67. I don't sleep more than 2 hours consecutively in any night. Haven't since 67. Some nights are more challenging than others. But when I fought with that, when I said, there's something wrong with me because I don't sleep like everybody else sleeps. And first off, everybody doesn't sleep 8 hours a night. I know that. Now, I didn't know that then. Once it was through the process, the early processes of Buddhist practice for me, that I had this awakening. I said, geez, you know, this is just how I sleep. This is nothing wrong with me. I mean, because of that, this is like this because that was like that. So now What do I do with this? How do I live at peace with this unpeacefulness? And that takes time. It takes a willingness. I have to give up the fight about getting my life to conform to a standard. And I need some support in the process of doing that.
So inherent in all that is this acceptance of what is, acceptance of where we're at. And on my own journey, I found that acceptance in that moment or moments is what tends to lead me to the darkest parts of myself. So I understand my own inner resistance sometimes of accepting what is in whatever moment. Sometimes it's really easy to do, but other times when I'm facing something within myself, that acceptance is scary. And ultimately, you know, I followed the path to somehow not being lovable. How does a person journey to that acceptance of that unpeacefulness or whatever it is we're experiencing that we would in the 3D realm prefer it not to be there? How do we find our way to acceptance?
Well, although there are any number of resources that will give you the 5 easy steps, the 10 easy steps, the 12 easy steps, they'll give you the formula. I really don't believe there is a formula. I think it rests in our willingness. I need to have a real willingness to live differently, to let go of my ideas, but not abandon them. So I begin to establish a different relationship with all of that. It reminds me, though, some years back, I was in a European country, and I was walking down the street, and there was a bookstore there. And in the bookstore, there was this book, and the title of the book is "Too Much Positive Thinking Makes You Sick."
I love it.
and I, when I read that, it just so resonated with me. I went, yeah. You know, it's like I cannot, if I'm too open-minded, my brain falls out. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when I get too caught up in attempting to get life conformed to the way I think it ought to be. And for me, that the path has just been willing to sit down, be willing to slow down, be willing to invite, just to be willing to invite more calm into my life, whatever that means. It's meant different things at different times. And so calm doesn't, if I think calm means this, calm doesn't necessarily mean what I think it means, because all of these terms are organic states. They are not fixed positions. It's like peace, it's like love, it's like compassion. And they're not static places. They're quite alive and organic. And life informs me if I allow myself, if I put myself in the position where I have the opportunity to listen to what life is telling me.
So you've written a couple of books, and your first book was about your journey and your own process and some of your teachings about that. And your latest book is
the one on
meditations.
That's this one.
Yes. And I was amazed to read about all these different types of meditation. I think I probably knew about a dozen of them. And I love the way you've offered these up in a way because not everybody likes to approach meditation in the exact same way. And you're giving them a cornucopia of choices.
Well, they're not different types. There is only meditation. That's why it's really important that I stress meditation and daily life are not two things. So what I introduce people to are different forms of meditation,
right,
which are not other than things we do in our daily life. We walk, we eat, we talk. We have to learn how to listen. Brushing teeth. If I'm doing it with full attention in that moment, if I'm brushing my teeth and I'm thinking about 50 other things, then I'm not present with what I'm doing. But if I'm present with what I'm doing, that is what meditation is. And it applies to everything we do all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm a great advocate of sitting as the root form of an active meditation practice. So I do encourage people that even if it's for 5 minutes, every morning, every evening, sit. Just sit, connect with your breath. Because the breath is the essential point of sitting meditation, to develop a conscious active relation with our breath. I'm not sitting for stress reduction. I'm not sitting for enlightenment, because any idea I have about all that stuff is then I'm not sitting.
Yeah. I love this concept of not sitting for enlightenment, because I think much of what is unfolded over the last several decades has been this proverbial carrot that we've been chasing after, you know, spiritual enlightenment, and with it, you know, feeling so much better, having life manifest in a different way. And although there may be aspects of that, it's that attachment to it getting us somewhere as opposed to allowing.
Yeah, if I may, study is a critical point of a disciplined spiritual practice. Study is not it. It's not only it. Study is just information that I gather. It's what I do with that information that expresses the truth of my practice. However, in one of the pieces that I was studying, there was this discourse about enlightenment. And somebody asked a learned teacher what enlightenment was for him. And he said, that I know my nose is on my face. Right? And I went, yeah, that's good. Because we have all these wild ideas about transcendent states. And
yes,
we have all these ideas about, I have so many people say, you know, I can't get this meditation thing. My thoughts won't stop. I go, listen, if your thoughts stop, you're brain dead. You're not supposed to stop.
Yeah.
It's our relationship with that. What stops is that our thoughts less and less become the driving force in determining our relationship with the world which we're a part of. This conversation, Christine, is exciting. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. No, I'm definitely thinking, but it's funny because having this conversation with you, I've got the sun shining, which is unusual this time of year in Seattle. I should have closed my shade.
All right, for sunshine.
having this conversation with you, yes, it gets me to think in different ways, but there's something deeper that unfolds in conversation. It's a reorientation of, this is the best way I can put it, my conscious relationship with my body, my conscious relationship with my senses, my conscious relationship with my thoughts. It's something more ethereal than thinking or even sensorily feeling. I'm having a hard time defining.
No, I'm following you. It, what you're saying is pointing in the direction of the experience, mm-hmm. of the reality of an active meditation practice. And so it is. I mean, words always fall short. Words simply point in a direction. And so I'm becoming more and more conscious of that. I also understand that in the practice of deep listening and mindful speech, which is a meditation practice. It's about understanding that the language, the words that I use to express a position, carry an enormous amount of weight. And so to be really thoughtful and to be thoughtful about what it is that I am saying and to be thoughtful about how I'm saying.
Yeah. I've also found that being a mindful of the words coming out of my mouth as they've come out also informs me about my belief system, mm-hmm. The words that I'm using that can illuminate how I may not be truly understanding where I'm coming from, or it might illuminate aspects of my own attachment or shadow side. Words are powerful in terms of what we offer to others, but it's also powerful in terms of illuminating our own ways of being, you know, structuring our beliefs, structuring our life.
Absolutely. Well said. Because it's also true. So at a certain point in my life, I was living homeless on the streets in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was living in an abandoned car in an alleyway between 6th and Liberty. Those are just two streets, two main streets. So to know that's still me, but to know that I was living there, and when I was living there, I was thinking, yeah, well, this is good, man. I'm in a good place here. To see the opportunities that are presented to me today, simply because I'm not, well, one, because I've worked really hard to clean up the wreckage of my past, but to the consistent effort to not hide, to really be ruthless in this process of looking at the roots of war, violence, and suffering in me, mm-hmm. and understand how they're passed on to me. When I'm given the opportunity to speak publicly or in a conversation like this, I also listen to myself. Because like you said, it's in that process. I go, and afterwards I might go, wow, man, did I really say that? Ooh, you know, I gotta look at that. Yeah.
And just in our conversation earlier on, when I was talking about masculinity, just you're basically saying, well, that's attachment to a tribe, attachment to a belief system. And it's like, oh, okay, well, here I am busy trying to release some of my belief systems about tribalism. And I've just, you know, put out another word, another belief that is absolutely tribal in nature. Mm-hmm. And so conversations can illuminate for us ways in which, you know, we're still living in a belief jail, so to speak. Hmm. Another bar of the jail.
Yeah, if we're willing to have conversations. This is a struggle in a lot of times today to really have open conversations with people, regardless of where on the spectrum they fall. And when we talk about tribalism, it's people are so locked into their belief structures that it's really challenging to have sort of open exploratory conversations with them. And look, I said on the other show, I said, look, I jump out of airplanes, I scuba dive, I like to ride motorcycles, I'm physically still pretty fit, I like to do a lot of those kinds of things. But those are just things that I like to do. They're not a definition of who I am, or I don't do them because I used to do them because I like them. You know, I enjoy that sort of thing. And I'm not shy to say that I enjoy it. You know, I like to, there's a form of rappelling that I learned in the military. They call it Australian rappel, where you go off the cliff edge, or you go off the edge of whatever you're going off face first. and your control is with one hand, so you have another hand free. You know, and it's like, I like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't make any apologies about that.
Uh-huh. And, nor should you.
I don't know. But in certain circles, I'm not supposed to like that stuff.
Oh yeah.
No, it's like another jail. Yes. Like this and that's the problem. And I just go, okay, well. Yeah.
Well, I think we get very stuck in this concept of what it means to be spiritual. I mean, that in and of itself is a huge jail from my perspective. But before we go any further, because we're going to run out of time soon, I want you to share with our listeners and viewers how they can connect with you, where they can find your books,
sure,
and what it is you offer.
The best place the centrally located place would be the website. And that will be, you can find that at www.zalto, that's ZALTHO.org. Since COVID, as soon as COVID broke and things started to shut down, we immediately went online here at the Magnolia Zen Center. Right now I'm calling in from the Magnolia Zen Center in Mary Esther, Florida. Generally, I'm traveling like 260 days a year, but that disappeared with COVID.
Right.
And so it disappeared in a way. I'm still traveling. I'm just traveling like this.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. instead of me having to come out to Oregon, I mean to Washington State,
yeah,
and sit down with you face to face, we have this opportunity.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing to me. So we have formal online sitting every Thursday at 6 p.m. Central Time. Florida has two time zones. We're in Central Time. Every Saturday. We sit at 8 o'clock in the morning Central Time. We have formal sitting and recitations. Anyone's welcome to come. It's open. If they want to come, they can, to get the address, they can dial into the website and there's an address where they can write to, and then the information will be provided to them. Mm-hmm. The two books are available through multiple sources.
Uh-huh.
So you can find out what those sources are on the website. You can also, they're both available on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, like I said, they're, I mean, I was, somebody asked me and I was reading them off and there's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's 7 different sites that the hard copy is available on. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sites where the ebook is available.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I really do appreciate your latest book because it helped me to look at meditation in a different way.
Oh,
some of it wasn't a surprise. Some of it was like, oh, it was very mind expanding in terms of my perception of what meditation is. Again, everybody, it's ZALTHO.org.
Yes.
Okay. In a minute or less, you have a final message for our listeners and viewers.
Yeah. Every morning, first thing you do when you get up, make your bed like you never slept in it, and then sit for 5 minutes. Concentrate on your breath. Breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth. Don't follow the breath into your body. Pay attention to the precise point where it enters. And when breathing out, don't follow your breath out of the body. Pay attention to the precise point where it leaves the body. And every night before you go to bed, repeat the process.
I love that. Claude, I am so grateful that you have shared your own tragic and healing journey with the world in the ways that you have. And I thank you for having this conversation with me today.
I tell you, Christine, it's been great. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate meeting you. I also say purple is a really nice color. I like it.
Thank you. I love purple too. Magenta and purple are my colors. Yes.
Great.
Thanks again, Claude, and thank you to all the viewers and listeners for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you'd like to empower yourself to step further into your vibration of change, please visit my website at christineupchurch.com, where you can learn more about my insights, upcoming events, and private sessions.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.